Well, since we have such a small group, I think we're going to have more of a conversation than anything else, which is better, I think.
PowerPoint?
And we're not going to do PowerPoint.
I'll need shadow.
Yeah, and I think, I'm not sure, perhaps brief introductions are in order, and I thought what we might do is have Dan and Nadia and myself just briefly explain the circumstances of our mediatizing, and then just throw it open to a conversation about common issues among everybody in terms of the systems that are in place and what's set up and what works and what doesn't. So perhaps we should go. Dan, you want to just give a brief introduction to the system that you guys have and how it runs? And,
yeah, sure.
And then just so everybody has the same background.
Right. So I'm a professor at MIT. I run the science writing program here, which is one of the oldest science journalism programs anywhere. It's like we're now our 31st class right now. And our model is a little bit different. NYU, of course, has standard college newspaper, the Washington Square News. And there are a couple of very exciting web-based publications, NYU Local, they do a great job. And there are a couple of other ones that are sort of more underground type newspapers. And it's great with you know, digital platforms. Some newspapers come and go, and it's a little bit like the 60s, you know, it's kind of a feeling of the alternative press at the university. Our model is different. What we do is, you know, we're a niche program. We do science, medicine, yeah, science, health, and environmental. So our students really feed into specific kinds of work. You know, most of the science publications, certainly in the Northeast, they're just loaded with graduates of our program. So we have to think really carefully about what our students need. And what we decided is that, you know, we would look carefully at what worked for them, what helps their professional development, and secondly, what there was a market for. Because really, there's no point in publishing if people aren't going to read the work. I mean, the students ultimately realize that and get discouraged. And so you really want to try to build an audience. And so we've done this. We have a sort of a stable platform, ScienceLine.org, that gets 2 million clicks a year, so it works, and it feeds on itself, because the more traffic there is, the more interaction with readers, the more excited the students are to do it, and they're not paid. So the trick is to identify a niche that works for your students, and that there's will attract readers, you know, will attract visitors, and then give the students, you know, true freedom to build on that platform, you know, while still making sure that you're covered in terms of libel and basic standards. So my advice is to, if other programs are thinking about doing this, don't only think in terms of geography, you know, because in the digital world, geography is just one way of organizing your content, and not even probably the best way. You know, think about communities of interest, and you know, not even saying that in Montana, you know, there was some talk of building a site, a permanent site for wildfires, you know, wildfire management. I think that is a great idea, and I think that that is smarter than having a sort of a temporary site that goes up or down, or having a geography-based site around your community, which is really very small, because one's community, which can be very small, because you don't necessarily get the traffic. And, you know, in terms of the professional development of your students, you're not necessarily feeding them into the places, other journals and outlets. And the last thing I wanted to mention about our model that really works is that because the content is not geographically limited? I mean, often there are stories based around New York because that's where we are, but the stories really could run anywhere, and they do. So we have these syndication agreements with Scientific American and Popular Science and On Earth and Popular Mechanics, and there's one more that I forget, Discover. And the students get really excited about that. And so again, that feeds, just like the traffic numbers, the syndication keeps the students motivated and keeps them working. So you can identify something that is not necessarily geographically limited and make that work. It so many good things happen for your program in terms of the profile of your program, and great things happen for your students. In terms of them getting clips that actually help them get jobs.
What percentage of your students participate?
All.
All. And is it mandatory?
But, we never actually say that it's mandatory. And I guess over the years we've had one or two that just barely did anything. but it's just sort of in the culture of our program that they all want to do it. And of course some are more involved than others. Like one of my students who's here today is the editor-in-chief of the second half of the year. She is very involved, Kelly. But they all help in one way.
And how big is the cohort, typically?
15.
15.
These are all grad students?
They're all grad students. And it works well because we are a year-and-a-half program, so there's an overlap in the fall. And so the fall is when the previous class trains.
Yeah.
An incoming class on how to use the site and how to use the content management system. That is good too, because the less that we're directly involved, the less this seems sort of top down, and the more it seems like this is their thing, the better.
Mm-hmm. Is this done as part of classwork?
Yes.
Or is this independent from classwork?
It's actually both. So they don't get a grade for anything they do for Science Line. But a lot of the content, they're very busy. They don't have a lot of time to go run around doing a lot of independent reporting outside of class. So a lot of the content was done originally for class. So it's been graded. It's been edited a couple of times already. On the other hand, the blogging, a lot of them have their own blogs, and the blogging is usually done not for class. And so that will be directly for the site.
I was just going to say, you mentioned libel screening. So,
yeah, we do that.
Since the stories are all graded, I guess, you've already been through that.
Right, well, they're not all graded. I mean, that's the thing, is that when stories have gone through class, we don't really worry about that, because they've already been through a professor. But one of my adjuncts, Ivan Ransky, who's a wonderful medical writer, he is the advisor for Science Line. He gets a little extra stipend for that. And one of the things he does, in addition to trying to syndicate out those stories to those commercial publications, is that he does look at everything for libel.
Sure. We're almost the polar opposite of Dan. Our program at the University of Montana is entirely undergrad. Some students are paid a little bit to do it. And it used to be that you could take it for credit, and you can't do that anymore. Not sure why. It's a 100-year-old traditional print newspaper. And our greatest challenge right now is creating a fully integrated newsroom that includes our broadcast students, and it's always been kind of print fiefdom with plenty of photo presence. The real desire is that it become a fully integrated newsroom with a complete online first kind of presence, but we wouldn't want the print product to go away, because we probably have the last captive print newspaper reading audience, since everybody does a crossword puzzle in class. So it's completely independent. I advise them to some effect at times. But they come to me when they need help. There's absolutely nothing that has to run by me. Libel is their own problem. I do try to keep them out of trouble. But
because it's a student publication as opposed to a curated program publication.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah.
I just...
Yeah, and it has long been a fairly powerful voice on campus. And it's, I have to say, been a little weak in the last few years on that. But that's not really true. We've had quite a few major national issues that the paper has led on. But it does change every year, actually every semester. They rehire, usually keeping the main editors. And they are funded by advertising on both the paper and the website, and by a $5 per semester fee that all students pay. And that had to be approved by a vote of the student body. And every once in a while, that gets shot down. So I think they went up for an increase 4 years ago and got shot down. They went up the next year and got their $5. And that... that does a decent job of covering costs. This year they decided not to publish, and this is a totally, they just made this decision, the student leaders did, not to publish a game day edition, which football is a big deal, because it was losing so much money. So they did not publish a game day except for homecoming and the Grizz-Cat rivalry, Montana State. And they took all that money and funneled it into 4 paid videographer positions. They are, okay, period. That's great, and a lot of the things that would be print features traditionally are showing up in quirky videos, and it's a regular, there are plenty of videos. Problem is that there's not a good platform for them. Videos are excruciating to let load and watch.
They don't have to be.
This is where they're captive by this university. So their current web platform is a prepackaged university. It's an outside vendor that does this site, and they're changing that like this week, and hopefully it will resolve the video issue. It should not be as big an issue, and I can't believe we ever went with the original site. But at any rate, they know it's a problem, and it should be better by the end of this month, by the end of October or November. But there is that effort to get to really more fully integrate the different disciplines to try to, we've kind of collapsed the silos in our curriculum. The Kaiman is called the Kaiman, which is a Salish word for a container of information. And that's a very nicely ecumenical word. And I'd hate to lose the Kaiman as the name of this publication, even as it becomes an online and more multidimensional platform. So that's what they're working towards now. And I think we'll get there. There's also a student radio station, and our broadcast students. The radio station has like no oversight or advising. It has news, and it has a news director. They are very much on their own, and they do their own wacky things, and they sell crazy sweatshirts for money. And then there's broadcast. Students do the morning news break-ins, so when you do the 3-minute local news update, those are our students doing news production. Those are not integrated with this, with the Kaiman. And that's one of the areas we'd like to see more integration. Is there room for a regular campus news update with broadcast that fits the broadcast aesthetic and is not part of the multimedia aesthetic, which is a constant battle in our building? And yet, all of those things, this integration has to come from the students. If there was any hint that we were requiring it from a faculty perspective, first of all, there's no mechanism for us to require it, and I think it would not work as well. I think that they would buy into it. So that's kind of where we are with it. It's an interesting time of change. Our current editor has been eager to make that push, and I think that tradition might. I expect it'll gain momentum. I don't see real reluctance about it, but there is a historic pride in putting out this 100-year-old newspaper. Sometimes that gets in their way.
Thanks. Well, my circumstance is kind of in between a little bit, but also different. University of St. Thomas is about 10,000 students in Minneapolis and St. Paul. It's 6,000 or so undergrads and maybe 3,500 grad students. And it's associated with the Archdiocese of Minneapolis and St. Paul, not a religious order, which is an important distinction at times. And the journalism program is about 400 undergrads, but that includes advertising, public relations, and traditional journalism. And so that's about the size, that gives you an idea of the size of the place. We had a 100-and-some-year-old print paper called the Aquin. St. Thomas Aquinas was the patron saint of the college, and so the Aquin was the newspaper. And in 2009, the faculty voted to kill it and go completely digital, so we've stopped. The printed edition has been gone for almost more than 3 years, so it's completely online. And at the time, we then merged the TV station and the radio station and the newspaper into one portal. And a couple things happened from that process. It's all, every student that worked there is paid. It's outside of class completely. The pay ranges from maybe $4,000 to what we call the executive director per semester. We did away with the title of editors, for various reasons. $4,000 down to maybe $350 for a reporter who's contributing maybe one story a week or so, or no more than that. Tiers of jobs. 60% of the funds come from the college and a fee similar to what you've got, and then 40% are sold by ads. So we have very aggressive ad staff. Staff totals about 45 students. And one of the things we were able to do with the savings from the ending of the printed paper, both from the cost of the paper, the printing itself, and the distribution, was to take those dollars and to hire more students. So we had a staff of maybe 32 putting out the printed paper, and were able to add another dozen students on salary and pay them with the savings that we realized from the end of the printed paper. It's a 24/7 operation. It's very local. We get probably 300,000, 350,000 hits a year. So we guarantee the advertisers a minimum of 1,000 a day. And I just looked at the numbers. Thursday this week we were 1634. Yesterday we were 1450. So we're averaging about 1,200 or so a day fall semester. So I sleep easy at night knowing the advertisers are getting what we've promised them. I don't know what would happen if we dip below that. Haven't come across that issue yet. But, we have heavy social media presence. A couple of things that we've learned is that 25% of our audience sees us through their smartphone. Roughly 55% of our audience comes from a link through Facebook or Twitter after we Facebook or tweet it. We're an AP member. We were the first all-digital AP member in the country. They didn't know how to sell us the product because they didn't have a contract that didn't have a print.
How much is that? Or how much do you... What's the arrangement?
Yeah, we'll pay between $2,500 and $3,000 a year for a basic AP. And then I just negotiated the contract last Friday for an a la carte service for both AP video and AP still images. So we don't have to buy AP photo stream, which is very expensive, or AP video, which is very expensive. But if we see a photo or a video we want, we'll pay $15 per photo or by the second for the length of the video. Sorry?
How much is for the a la carte for the video?
The photos are $15 each, and then the video per second, I think I figured out that the average video was going to cost us about $35, but that was for a clip of less than 20 seconds. So it's, I don't know, is that what you guys?
Well, for breaking news, actually, you know, you need that, but since we don't do a lot of breaking news, there's no reason for us to do that, but we do subscribe to a couple of stock photo services
yeah.
that are great.
It is a byproduct.
And a lot of times you don't even need that, because if you go to Google Images, those are all Creative Commons.
Yeah.
And you can use those. The problem is that when you have breaking news.
Right. And we insist on a graphic element with every story that's posted. So it's each story has an accompanying video or an accompanying still picture or accompanying graphic element. Yeah. So we have among the 45 students, there's a staff of 5 creative designers, and all they do is they do the ads, they design the ads for the advertisers, but they also do the news graphics and the in-house ads and everything else. So
I'm really glad that you mentioned where people come to you, because I think that's something that people don't pay enough attention to. You know, you can run Google Analytics on your site. You can learn a tremendous amount. Mm-hmm. Now, some of it's depressing, you know, like how much average time outside, or you know, you can
20 seconds.
You can see that, but yeah. And of course you can see which individual stories, you know, get traffic. But one of the most interesting things to learn is where people find you, and for our site, it's always been, you know, solid 2/3 from search, you know, where people are searching for a particular topic and then they find a story that one of our students has written. And then another, of the remaining third, it's split pretty evenly between people who go to the homepage because it's on their daily routine, and people who come through Twitter or Facebook.
I should also say that we have 6 faculty advisors, because it's a 24/7 operation, and we're not full-time, it's all counted as a course. So each of the faculty advisors is part of our 3 and 3 course load. One of the courses is to advise Tommy Media, and among the 6, each has a duty. So we'll have an advertising sales faculty advisor, we'll have a public relations faculty advisor, we'll have a video faculty advisor, a web faculty advisor, on the text copy, and so on. So we do two daily video shows a day. We do a sports show and a news show every day, Monday through Friday. We do a coach's show that's very popular with the football coach, a standard coach's show in a studio setting, and then a news show that's more of a 60 minutes type show once a week as well. But each of the faculty has the responsibilities in their area, and we're also required. The students are required to work shifts because it's run like a small daily. Students each work 2 2-hour shifts a week in the newsroom. Faculty work 2 4-hour shifts a week in the newsroom and supervise the breaking news coverage as well. And then we have a news huddle on a Sunday night that plans the week's events that the students run, and we just kind of sit there and make sure they don't call the Pope a fink, which is part of the Catholic nature of the
fink. Fink's not acceptable.
Fink is not acceptable, and we would get fired in a big hurry if that were to happen. So we do have the libel issues that we, and not only that, but we have the church issues that, because of the nature of the institution, we have to be sensitive to. But current administration has been very supportive and they've just been extremely supportive. I mean, they put resources into 6 faculty members allowed to work on this project for 45 students is a commitment of resources. And one of the things that we're able to show them, and I just completed this report last week, because they want outcome reports. I have 11 seniors in the spring. Of the 45, 11 graduated in the spring. 8 had jobs in the field before graduation. 2 got jobs over the summer, and the 11th went to Teach for America to take a year off. So we're able to prove that in our little corner of the world, and they're all getting jobs in the Midwest, small dailies, small TV stations, small magazines, but they can all shoot and edit video, write text stories, take still photographs, put up slideshows, and post it to the web.
That is another great thing about these platforms, is that for prospective employers, you know, we have our site set up, and I think a lot of places do this, maybe Mark, you do this too, that if you click on the kids' byline, their own page pops up and you can see all of their work. Mm-hmm. All their stories, also videos, graphics that they've built, plus a little bio on top, you know, with their Twitter handle and, you know, their personal webpage if they have one. So it's like a homepage. It's like the equivalent of their own homepage, except in a way it has more credibility because it's on a, you know, on the site, this traffic site.
We don't do the bio, which maybe I should think about, but they do.
It's easy to do.
Yeah. We did have an issue, and maybe others can speak to this too, of some students getting, I would say, hate email or problems with readers, you know, sending them in a couple of cases where it got a little, it made me feel uncomfortable. And so I thought about what to do about that, and I don't know what to do about that, but it makes the students extraordinarily nervous when that happens. And so I wonder about the bios a little bit, but...
Yeah, well, you know, they wouldn't... They would put a lot of, you know, they wouldn't say where they live.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, ultimately, my feeling about it is that it's pretty easy for someone to get someone's email. You know, you can't really, in the world of Google and Facebook and LinkedIn, I don't really know how you could keep someone's email private.
Yeah.
So.
In fact, I think that's one of the greatest lessons they can learn is to have thicker skin.
Yeah, to deal with those things. They could actually learn a lot from that. I mean, not the, you know, you don't want them to be harassed, but
right. But
you know, the dealing with the irrational critic is a really good thing to do.
Yeah.
You know,
we did. I should say, we in our comments section, we insist that the commenters' first and last name and email address and all the comments. We don't, and we moderate the comments, and that's part of the. That was an informed decision that we made with the students in terms of they wanted. You can still get plenty of comments, but if a commenter comes in with only a first name, we will write the commenter back and say, our policy is such, if you would like to resubmit it with your name, we'll consider it.
Our solution to that is that we allow pseudonyms, but we moderate all comments.
We
don't allow straight postings to. If you really have to do that because you get people, you know, selling their kidneys, you know. you get weird marketing, and you get kooks, and you get obscenity, you know, you get all kinds
of stuff. Yeah, we would have somebody call the Pope a thing pretty
So you do have to moderate the comments. We learned that. At first we didn't, but then we learned, okay, we have to have a line on comments.
Well, let me just throw it open to questions. Yeah, go ahead.
Is your website internally hosted?
It was, except we got some... I'm very proud of this, that we crashed the NYU journalism. Our site actually represents, you know, for our little science journalism program, you know, represents more than half of the total traffic to NYU journalism. So the university chipped up and got us our own server. It's still a university server,
do you have a webmaster?
Yes. No, I should have mentioned that. That's a sort of a hidden cost that we don't have to
cover. Is it a full-time person?
It's no, not just for us, but he is the webmaster for NYU journalism.
Okay.
We wind up taking a disproportionate amount of his time because we have so much traffic, but you know, we probably take a quarter of his time, you know, for only 15 students a year. We have 400 undergrads and 140 grad students. And we wind up taking up a lot of his time, but he's very nice about it.
You know, we don't have, and we've talked a lot about.
Yeah.
We rely on me and the other faculty members to be the webmaster.
That's really difficult,
and it's hard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And when there's problems like yesterday, you know, I was here. We had an issue with exporting video yesterday, and it's just a gigantic pain in the ass to fix it from as far away as. As we are, but that's a serious commitment on part of the university too.
So they bought servers, man. They bought servers for you, not external hosting.
No, in our case, they was an NYU server.
That's the same with us.
Yeah,
and we also wanted a server, a separate one. We didn't get it.
Why not just hosting? Is it that easier?
You know, it's nice to have. Some control over your server. You know, your hosting service might suck, you know. I mean,
if you're like, it sounds like your circumstance might be this, if they've got a crappy platform you might be stuck with.
Yeah.
You know, you might not be able to do all the things that you want to do, or if it's a little outdated, or you know.
One thing related to this too is you know, go with a nice WordPress server. That WordPress is really starting to dominate now, I think, in this field for good reason. And figure out a CMS that is customized for your needs, but one that the students really can handle the day-to-day stuff, because we don't want to bother Misha, is his name. We don't want to bother Misha, you know, our webmaster, just to post a story, or there's a problem with the headline that we need to adjust. And I think the students get a lot out of that, too. It's just the idea of sort of getting rolling up their sleeves and getting messy in the CMS and tinkering around and fixing things and adding plugins. We never add plugins without, you know, clearing it through the department, because, you know, there can be security issues. But I think it does the students a lot of good, and they're much better at it than me. I mean, I'm not in Mark's position at all. I couldn't get in there and do what the students do every day. It's just not really my, I've never bothered to learn.
Is there a student position that's in charge of that?
Yeah. Well, there's one editor and there's two managing editors, and one of the managing editors is sort of the traffic cop type. But we have also learned that you really don't want to rely on just one person to be your tech person. You really want to cross-train everything. And we changed positions after 6 months, you know. You know, which has really nice...
We do that, too.
Really good, you know, benefits educationally and resume-wise, but it also helps with cross-training because it forces people to learn multiple jobs.
We also are WordPress, and it's because it's becoming the dominant platform in the industry. We've got employers wanting that.
Absolutely.
And so we're able to tell them that they can handle it.
I think you have to do it for your mental health. I mean, we've been down the line of customized CMS. It's just a nightmare, and every tech guy comes in there and has got a brilliant idea.
Yeah.
No one can manipulate it. One thing that
And then the guy leaves, and who knows how to run it.
And the thing of it is, it's true. Content is king.
Yeah.
Have it look reasonable. It doesn't have to be great.
Yeah,
once in a while, it won't do what you want it to do.
Yeah.
But so what?
Has anybody used WordPress MU or what replaced it? Because I had a pretty serious issue with using that platform to expand a variety of news blogs, and it became unmaintainable for me. It actually put me off WordPress for a while. And I still use it for a couple things, but and what replaced it?
Why did it? You're talking about the spam and the
spam was.
It's always going to be that, don't
it? It was relentless. It was hundreds a minute. I couldn't figure out. I figured out how to block it from going to the inside pages, but I couldn't block it from going to the home page. And we had I'd never had it before.
You may need to upgrade your WordPress version.
I think that an upgrade. What happened is that WordPress stopped supporting multiple user platform, and so did our university. So in order to, I would have had to, and this is where you really want. I didn't have any full time tech support on this thing. I would have had to migrate all of these multiple user platform sites to whatever has replaced it. And I've heard what it is, but I don't know what it is. But
you know, that migration process is really easy now. It's relatively easy from one WordPress to, like, let's say you buy a remote hosting service, and then they keep your WordPress version up for you.
We actually have it on a remote server because the Grace case collapsed the entire university system.
Yeah, isn't that awesome?
It was awesome, except for it was a little frustrating.
Brought it to its knees.
It was a little frustrating, but it was kind of awesome. So I don't post anything on the university system anymore. The climate itself is, but my class projects aren't. But at any rate, I'd be interested in people's experience.
It's just not that expensive. You know, I don't know what you guys have found, but you know, there's some upfront cost. You either get your internal guy, or we actually hired an external guy. We paid him $3,000 or $4,000 6 years ago to initially design the site, and then we paid him another $3,000 or $4,000 to redesign the site. And he'll do complicated things that if our internal guy is just too busy to do, but everything else, the internal guy handles it. It's just not that difficult.
Yeah.
Have you thought about it being students? Like, ours is complete. Ours was designed by a student, and then myself and our student webmaster do all of the coding.
Which is great. We have thought about that, and some of the you know, every year we have three or four students that are really interested in coding. And what we do is some of them actually have done some coding, but we still feel like we want to run it. You know, we don't want to introduce any errors into a very heavily trafficked site. You know, we don't want to introduce any security problems into a heavily trafficked site, so we still run it by our webmaster, you know, for security reasons.
She mentioned
but it's a good idea. If you have someone who's technically capable, I think it's a great idea.
Yeah, ours has always been done by students. Yeah.
Did you say ours? I'm sorry, we don't know.
I'm a senior at Ithaca College, so the Ithacan,
great.
The newspaper, is all...
You're enjoying Tom Roshan, who was at our school before he went to yours. Thanks for taking him off our hands.
Appreciate that. I spent much too much time in his office yelling at him.
Yeah. Oh, me too. The funny part about... We had... This doesn't make you feel any better, but we had such a laugh when he left our school in 2008 to go to Ithaca as president because we knew the strength of the Ithaca Journalism School.
Yeah, we're awesome.
And you're awesome. And we knew what a pain in the ass he was to student journalists because we had dealt with him for 5 years that he was at our school, and we knew that pretty soon there was going to be a gigantic blow up, and sure enough, there was.
Like that's happening right now.
Right now.
So yeah, we have, luckily have the Park Foundation behind us.
Yeah.
So Adelaide Gomer, who's Roy H. Park's daughter, has oh so kindly spent some time in his office explaining how vitally important the Park Foundation is to the success of Ithaca College.
I'm sure he's been very gracious.
So. He's starting to step.
This session is being taped. Yeah.
Wow.
I think Sandra Steingraver is still there, right?
Yep.
She's
doing
it.
She's wonderful.
Yeah, she's great.
I actually thought Tom was a nice guy, but he didn't understand student journalism as well as others.
He still doesn't.
It is pretty.
It's a rare administrator that gives you the complete free rein.
I'm interested in the long run about whether the, you know, sort of the classic college newspaper model is going to stay with us, you know, because if you look on the web, you know, hyperlocal sites are really seriously struggling, whereas small sites that are based around some other community of interest but not necessarily geographic communities tend to do better. For a while, it seemed like many college newspapers were still quite profitable. But I'm getting the sense now that things are changing, and I do wonder in the long run whether sort of the classic college model that, you know, I was the editor in chief of my paper, you know, when I was at school. I guess it's going to continue, but I still wonder if ultimately that is the best model for training people who really want to be journalists, as opposed to people who care a lot about their school and are interested in issues at the school, but are not necessarily focused on a career in journalism. I'd be curious to hear what people think about that.
I think not. We have serious disagreements and difficulties with our student affairs organized publications, and they're perfectly happy to go right up to the edge of prior restraint, and in many other areas they do expression
a lot of really difficult incidents.
So we can't get journalism professors to work with student media. They just throw up their hands and say I'm out of here, I'm not working with these guys anymore.
Which school are you?
Radford University, and same sort of thing kind of is happening down at Virginia Tech. They have a different set of issues, but so Tech and Radford are like brother and sister schools.
I think it may be in the long run that some of the, you know, there's going to be a distinction between the student press at some of these schools, not necessarily the place where the future journalists go, but the people who really care about campus politics, campus issues, but not necessarily journalism.
just that when you go and journalism by caring about something, I mean, like, you could write about some topic far away and like, ooh, that's journalism, but isn't like, you know, making a better school. I mean, it's kind of.
I hope so. Yeah. I mean, I hope that doesn't happen, but I do see it happening. I think it's going to be a really long process, and I think colleges and universities are going to have publications for a really long time, maybe forever. I do think, though, that as journalism continues to evolve, that the idea of a geography-based publication or site is going to continue to be less important.
Dan, are you thinking it is less important to the community or less important to the training of future journalists?
I actually think both.
Uh-huh.
Because if it's less important to the community, to the geographic community, then the demand for the work obviously won't necessarily be geographic based. Mm-hmm. It'll be other kinds of communities of interest.
So are you also
both, though? I mean, the hyperlocal still really works, I think.
It doesn't work financially.
I mean, there's still going to be communities that need local news. And it seems like local news is also... seems like there's two different trends going on. I don't know. I could be wrong. But it seems to me like there's two very different trends that are going on with the hyper-local, you know, what's going on at a very local level. And then there's also the opposite trend, you know, with what you're talking about, being able to write content, you know, produce content that could be published anywhere. And we had an interesting example of that last week on Canvas, where we had New York Magazine was there. I don't know if you went to Adam Moss's thing, but Adam Moss, the editor of New York Magazine, was there. He said, you know, very different set of issues, but it was just interesting to hear him say that, you know, they started as this hyper-local, obviously New York-oriented publication, and now, you know, they're making most of their money on their website, selling ads on their website. 90% of the content that they produce, the original content they produce, goes online directly. And it's content that could run, would be of interest anywhere in the globe, really. And only 10% of their content that they produce goes into the print version.
And interestingly, it's really interesting that you brought that up, Sarah, because Adam Moss is now working with NYU. NYU has a big hyperlocal site that they did with the New York Times for a couple of years, called the LEV, the Lower East, Local East Village. And it was fine, but then ultimately the Times lost interest. And so now they're actually talking to Adam at New York Magazine. And because of that phenomenon that you pointed out, that New York Magazine increasingly... it's about New York, but not necessarily for New Yorkers. It's for people who want to know what's going on. They identify with New York, but they're not necessarily in New York. So they are now talking to NYU about having a partnership with NYU that would sort of replace this previous site and instead would deliver the New York-style content that they're not necessarily delivering in the mag. More service oriented.
So they would do some local, come around and do the local stuff there.
Right, via NYU.
Yeah.
And it's just a lot of experimentation going on, you know. And I do think, I'm being a little bit hyperbolic about the future of hyperlocal, but most hyperlocal is not working financially. You know, we should be honest about that. I mean, that's the truth. And ultimately, I do think that college and university publications are going to be effective. And I think they already are. I mean, did you guys follow the whole University of Georgia, you know, red and black thing from a few months ago? I mean, there was a huge blow up about that. And it was basically financial in nature that they weren't able to deliver the circ and clicks that they were telling their advertisers. And they had a very expensive, you know, professional staff making good salaries, you know, that were not students. And then the professional staff essentially began to dictate content parameters to the students because of the financial pressure on
the publication as a whole, and then the students pushed back, and it became a whole thing. And ultimately, there was a good resolution for journalism, but I think that there's going to be more of that. There's going to be more of that, because the same pressures that are making hyperlocal digital in the professional world difficult are going to affect college media too. I'm sure.
Well, one of the interesting things that happened in our experience is that all these unexpected, you plan and you set a path and you think you've got it sort of planned out, is that when we killed the printed paper, the alums were very unhappy, and they let us know about it in no uncertain terms, and that was not something that we had expected at all. We got letters from, and I guess I didn't think it through to realize that they had been receiving it by mail wherever they were, and they were of an age where they didn't really want to consume their news online, and they, you know, they wanted it in the mail, and we got a very letter from the letters would be like, I would get my cup of coffee and I would get the paper and I would sit on the porch and I would, you know, and it was that kind of thing, and there was a lot more blowback than any of us had ever thought was gonna happen, but it died down fairly quickly as the alums, I think, got used to either going online, or maybe they don't read it anymore. I don't know.
Well, let me ask Ken, when you say that there's sort of questionable future, I mean, can you distinguish between the lab papers and the student papers in student affairs? So a lab, what we used to call lab papers, right? Which is the kind that you're running there at NYU Science Line, is kind of a lab paper for your program. And then, Nadia, you've got you're working with student affairs and people in the student, they're not in the journalism program. Your publication is not actually inside the journalism program, right?
Physically, it is, but materially, it's outside. Their newsroom, which is nicer than most that I ever worked in, is completely paid for by
nicer than the store.
But it was entirely paid for. I mean, our entire building was paid for by private funds, and their newsroom was paid for entirely by a single donation from an editor of the Kaiman who was killed in a motorcycle accident shortly after he left, and they endowed several big things for us and paid for the entire newsroom. We rebuilt our building. So physically, in many different ways, they are separate from us, but physically they are located in the building. So
I'm not sure what matters that much, really. What matters is what kind of traffic do they get, and if they have a revenue model, you know, what kind of revenue do they raise? And, you know, all these publications are going to have to, you know, stand or fall on their own. We don't have a revenue model. We don't take advertising. And it's all volunteer. Ours is very clear. On the other hand, we don't have the responsibility of covering breaking news in a defined community, so we can get away with that.
Do you know what your total budget is?
For that site? I've never really figured it out that way, but if you include the advisement and everything, it's maybe $12,000 a year, $14,000 a year, something like that.
It's a bargain.
It's nothing.
Yeah.
We do several, what you're calling lab classes that put out
publications
that are enduring and successful, and they are frequently, and probably the most famous is Native News, which covers all the 35 years old now, covers all the reservations with a single topic, covers all reservations around the state. It's probably one of the consistently best sources of news about Indians in America, in the country. It's really a phenomenal.
Which is a classic example of a model that has a real future, I think. You know, because that is a community of interest that transcends geographic boundaries, that where people are passionately interested.
Financially, you know, it's not an it's distributed across the state in a couple of different newspapers. It's got an online component now, and it's moved and become fully integrated multimedia, but it is kind of underwritten by a variety of nonprofits and by the school. So it's not an advertising driven model.
Well, I think the opportunity for university news sites, it's not on campus, it's out there. I mean, this is a time for experimentation, and we should throw a lot of crap against the wall and see what sticks.
Yeah,
and I think it's a real underexploited. I mean, if we work for institutions that value the dissemination of knowledge and information, what better function for a university to foster than to foster journalism? Now, that's a speech I give my faculty, and they all roll their eyes and get in my soapbox. But, you know, and there's some real opportunity. I mean, we do. The strangest thing that's happened at our news site, we have an environmental news site. All we do is cover the environment. The news community is defined by the Great Lakes watershed, parts of 8 states, 2 Canadian provinces. And so as a result of that, we get contributions now from the University of Minnesota School of Journalism, which is providing us Lake Superior news. Kent State has provided us with some really good sustainable agriculture, mini documentaries. SUNY Oswego says they want to be our Lake Ontario Bureau, which, you know, we'll see how that works out. But and you get a lot of excitement from some of the other schools, and that never really pans out. But I think looking for those opportunities and beyond, we don't have to be only student oriented. In fact, I would like to grow our program to the point where the students were the minor part of what's going on. So I go out and raise money and hire freelancers. Just this week, we've had 2 SEJ members with stories in our publication, and I think we need to experiment with that because there's a lot wrong with journalism, but that means there's a lot of opportunity to try to figure something out. Should we be the leaders in doing this kind of thing?
Yeah.
Here's a really odd thing that happened to us is one of my graduate students who graduated last spring, very good, and he got Peter Dykstra hired him over at Environmental Health News precisely because of the type of work he was doing with our site, precisely because EHN wanted to get a stronger Midwest presence and bring his sources with him over there. Guess what? Every time he writes a Great Lakes story, we take it and we run it in ours. So those kinds of relationships really, you know, really kind of pay up. And we're coming across some weird things, like there's a group of environmental educators in Buffalo who decided that they wanted to explain environmental issues through comedy. And they started cutting these videos. And we just stumbled over them, and we said, hey, what if we play them over at all? They just thought it was great, you know, drove a whole lot of readership. So once a month, we run one of their looking at it videos. And I think we got to look for those opportunities.
You know, what you say is really profoundly true for us, too. We've experimented with all kinds of crazy stuff, mostly the social media crazy stuff, because we can.
Yeah.
And we don't have the financial. I mean, we do have some financial constraints based on ad sales and so on, but we don't have the financial constraints that a small daily would have where we can really experiment. And if it fails, we just stop doing it and try something else.
Failure is just considered part of the process. It's fine to fail.
Yeah.
It's not okay to libel someone, but short of that, it's okay to fail.
Yeah.
It's okay for something not to work out. And that's really great. I mean, you got to give the students plenty of room just to mess around and see what works.
Yeah.
So we definitely do that. And sometimes, there's embarrassing stuff on the site, from years back, and somebody will see it or whatever. But you just say, well, that's all part of the process.
It's funny. What defines success and failure can really vary. And the site that I was saying was just a disaster. I have to kind of laugh because it was a coordinated site between my graduate class and the law school. The law school considers it a huge, roaring success. So, Ugg boots and Air Jordans aside, and those internal sites have maintained their integrity after I kind of whooped them up. But their expectations for an audience were a little bit lower. Their expectations for public interaction. It was so surprising to them how quickly we could become a must-read source on a very specific local issue. And so they had written up the project as a great success in many law teaching journals. And this was a water project we did last year. So it is kind of funny, what does it take to succeed with what kind of audience? And it was a very discreet project, and I've been approached by another student this year to do another discreet project. And the problem is it's fairly difficult to get a large number of students to have experience in it unless they volunteer. I can easily put them to work, but I don't have a mechanism to encourage them or pay them or reward them other than saying this is a great experience to learn about this issue.
And part of that is really getting them to think, like Dave was saying, to think outside of the university. You don't just have to write stories about what's happening at your university. Just write the best stories you can.
Yeah.
Maybe it's about
some of
the university, maybe it's not.
Some of the heaviest traffic we get are stories that are regional, maybe, but not necessarily university.
Just go do journalism. And the wonderful thing about this new crazy model that we're in is that individual stories are the key unit, not the publication.
Mm-hmm.
And through social media, we've had stories that have gotten a couple hundred thousand hits, just via social media.
Well, the other thing about it is there's such great stories that aren't getting told that it's easy for them. I mean, they're just sitting there on the ground and nobody's telling these stories. They're going to come and go with it.
And they're always shocked that people will call them back and say, well, of course they'll call you back. No one ever calls them. They're happy to talk to you.
One point I wanted to make, though, is like the stuff we're talking about, we got to think about it in terms of it can generate support for your program as well. So at our university, and many universities, maybe yours as well, there's this URAP program, that's an acronym, the Undergraduate Research Opportunity Program.
Mm-hmm.
And it's to give undergraduates a chance to do some research, and all the research side of my department, the ones that tap into. Well, we ran a research project for our new service, and it was called Researching Non-Traditional Methods of Communicating Complex Environmental Issues to the Public. Another word for that is being a reporter. We got money by catching it that way. My reporter had to put together a poster session, give her presentation. Here's the guy who's curing cancer over here, and someone else was doing something. Erin, she was writing a news story. It went over real well, but the big thing for me was it tapped the university bucket of money that I would have had otherwise.
And if you're interested in science, if your content is science related, think about NSF too. There's lots. Their whole thing now is to really try to push public communication of science. And you might even find there are researchers at your university that have grants pending with NSF, and they desperately need an outreach component to their grant, and you can help provide that.
We've done that, and it's tricky. The tricky thing is we need you here to promote my individual research.
You can get around that.
But you can get around it, you just have to negotiate it.
We had that exact same problem, but it is possible to
do. Dan, we just got one of those. And it would be really interesting. Yeah, we got $250,000. And it's going to be interesting to see how it works. I am not 100% sold that I'm going to like the journalism that comes out of it.
Yeah.
But it is a lot of money, and it's going to be attractive, I think, for recruiting. But you had to be very specific about what audience you're steering your STEM stories to. And so the pitch, and what got it for us, was underserved communities in Montana, which means native and rural, and which really means not the internet.
Mm-hmm. How you got the result.
And not print. So we are about to become more invested in radio. I mean, we are already heavy in radio, but radio is it for Native America, and it is somewhat it for rural America, deeply rural America. And the threshold for what we have to produce for it is extremely low in terms of the number of stories, and it'll be very easy to hit the number of the story count that we promised. But we then have to do in a way that you don't have to for anything else is really show that it's making an impact in these communities. So developing relationships with the radio stations.
So you have to show that if you want your grant renewed.
Well, actually, we have to show it if we want to go to the next funding level. The $250,000 is our proving budget. So, and it's a question: do we want it renewed? Is going to be a question. Does it work? And does it work for us?
Yeah, that is a consideration too. There's money that is helpful, and there's also money that is not really helpful. that's not consistent with your mission. It's not really going to help your kids.
Right, and this is a great thing. I'm not going to say getting $250,000 isn't a pretty good thing, but it's going to be interesting to see how it really plays out in reality for our students who drive it and for the population we're serving.
You know, we've had a couple of projects like this, and this might be like a slippery slope argument, but this is how I rationalized it, is a flawed model of journalism is better than no journalism. These stories wouldn't be covered otherwise. And you know what? If it blows up, what a wonderful learning experience it is for your students. You see, this is why we need a strong, vigorous, independent press.
Yeah, I'm not
so things like this don't happen.
Yes. Journalistically, I'm not really worried about it, except for that it's...
I actually think that those pushback things, like what happened at the with the Red and Black in Georgia, that was the best possible learning experience for the students. I mean, it really was. So it's all good. I mean, that's one of the most exciting things about this new model is just everything is now okay. You know, everything is okay to try. Just try it. What the hell? Try it. And the opportunity,
and it's easier for us.
The opportunity costs are low, you know, and the possible rewards are high. So
we do
try it.
You know, we did something goofy with the we have a popular football team, and so we'll throw a whole bunch of resources at every football game. We'll do a social media feed from Twitter and Facebook. We'll do a halftime text story, end of the game text. We'll do a slideshow and a video package. And we throw more resources at a Division III college football game than the Star Tribune does at a Vikings game.
Yeah.
I mean, it's true in terms of manpower, but they're not able to do a video package of game footage because of the rights issues. And, I mean, we can do stuff that they can't do. But the students get tremendous experience that they really wouldn't get even as an intern at a paper.
What
like
happens
that.
When your football team goes south?
People watch it anyway.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't, you know, we figured out that the winning and the losing is not really related.
How
to
about the raping and the arresting?
Yeah, see, now we're in Division III. No scholarships.
I mean, I'm serious.
Well, we don't. We have not run into.
Are you able to do hard news?
We haven't had any. I mean, again, we're small, no scholarship program, and so
the students have that blue football field.
We're not. We're green to red. Our neighbors are red.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm
I'm just curious. Do you have a sense for? I think it's through all that tweeting and football game would be a lot of fun for the students. But are people consuming it?
Yes.
Is it working
both ways? Well, here's what we're again. It's all an experiment, and some of it's a huge fail. We overdid it this year at first, and as best I can tell, here's how I'm tracking it. We 3 years ago when we started, we would with our tweeting of sporting events. Football, for example, every score, end of half, or end of quarter, end of half, end of game, and that was it. And as the students got more excited about doing it, they started, it was almost a play-by-play circumstance. Yeah. It was too much, and what that did was it robbed Peter to pay Paul, and so our web traffic dropped considerably because we'd already given them everything on the Twitter feed. And so the advertisers who are not represented on Twitter did not get the traffic that we had suggested that they would get.
But what a great learning
experience. Yes,
it was outstanding.
Yes, yeah. Exactly right.
And so last week's game, we trimmed way back on Twitter, always linking to the website, but we cut way back on the play-by-play, thinking we'll force the reader to go to the website to read the actual game story, to look at the video, to look at the slideshow, and the traffic tripled to the site. Now, not all that, I don't think you can attribute all that to the Twitter's because it was a better opponent, two nationally ranked teams, you know, I think other stuff, other variables in play, but the traffic increased considerably.
But you know, what you just described there is what our research colleagues get a lot of money to do.
Yeah.
and having said that, I mean, is there an opportunity there for you to go after research funds to take 8 months to do what you've explained?
Yeah,
I wouldn't want to deprive the students of that. I mean, it's such great preparation for professional journalism now when you really need to be entrepreneurial, you really need to think deeply about your analytics and think deeply about your marketing, you know, as a professional. I wouldn't want to cede that to the researchers.
Well, but they would still do it all. You would just turn it into a research project.
Yeah, just for the
money. I'm just speaking as a guy who's looking for money at any time.
Well, yeah, I mean, that we do.
But you have to be enthused about doing that research, and my sense is you're not.
No, I'm trying to keep my head above water, and, you know, I'll be enthused about that, and then the website will break, or the, you know, like the video doesn't export, or it doesn't load, or, you know, stuff. There's a lot of troubleshooting that goes on.
Yeah.
And I wish we had a full-time web guy.
It's really helpful.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's actually
always say,
the key to the kingdom.
We they run it themselves, we won't even be bothering you, but we wind up bothering him, you know, a couple times a week for one thing or another.
Yeah.
Has he been there for a while, or is there turnover?
There is turnover.
It seems like a crappy job.
There is turnover. He did pay pretty well. But yeah, we're on for the, you know, 6 years of this program, we're on our fourth one. And some of them better than others. But for them, the problems that we have are very easy to fix. It's not difficult. For us, it would be difficult. Just, you know, the whole thing, the barriers to entry are just not there. You know, there are barely any barriers to entry. So you don't enter.
If I can, we're getting close to time, and I've been talking to Bill and Tom last night about this. Massive segue. First of all, let's remember that SEJ EU exists. What is that? What it's called? No, we call it online. Then we can continue this conversation. That there exists. That Bill has done a lot of work, and Sarah has done some work on it. This a curriculum, a sample curriculum for teaching environmental journalism. This is a call that SEJ gets from time to time. Bill's putting the lion's share of the work and would like, it's a Google Doc, and would like some backup eyes and some new ideas or not on it. And let's try to do that and get it turned around before the end of the semester so that we can get it up on the SEJ website. And
right now
and
it's not on the website yet.
It's on Google Docs, and it just needs to be gone over and a lot of people need to take a look at it, make sure they're comfortable with it.
Yeah, while you're at it,
it could be improved.
Yeah, I mean, I think it can be, and this is obviously a moving target.
It can be improved.
So it'd be great to get that up there and just to take a look at the website, the academic area, and if there's stuff up there that you think is dated or old or underplayed. I think
there's some old syllabi from classes.
Yeah.
Some of the syllabi, I'm the worst offender. You know, I think the syllabi that's up there from my class is from 6 years ago.
Generally, the website needs to be cleaned out.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
This is part of it, actually, but there's other things that need to be done as well.
I do think that having a syllabi up there is really useful.
Yeah.
People, you know, we all steal from each other, let's face it.
We'll update it, maybe. It's more the word.
Well, as that comes around, Dan, give everybody the name of your website one more time.
Oh, Science Line. One more.
We are
ScienceLine.org.
ScienceLine.org.
Montana Kaiman.
How's that spelled?
KAIMIN.com.
Oh, traditional spelling.
And traditional spelling. And it's actually pronounced Kaimin.
Yeah.
And I expect it to change. So look at it now because I think it'll be different in a week. And I have no idea what it's going to look like.
And if other people have sites that they know of that are doing cool things, this is a great time to
Great Lakes. Okay.
Yeah, Dave's Great
Lakes. Mine is Tommy Media, TOMMIE, TommyMedia.com.
Ours is theboulderstand.org.
The Boulder Stand.
Yes.
Well, I thought it was Boulder Stand, as in like Afghanistan.
We call that the Boulder Stand. Let's make sure you're
anybody else?
No brain.
Dave,
Boulder
we got
BoulderStand.org.
Who's got other sites too?
Sure, we're Sage Magazine. We're a publication of the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies.
Yep.
Sage Magazine.org.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's
the
BoulderStand.org. I said
.org or .com.
That would be.
We have a classroom blog called Muddy Boots News.
Muddy Boots News.
Yeah,
lovely. Great. Anybody?
Ours is the Ithacan.
Ithacan.org. Yep.
this semester, Vox90.com has nothing to do with was
give her a semester.
Environmental News.
For another semester.
Yeah.
Vox, V-O-X?
V-O-X.
Okay.
So is your idea set of eventually the zoo on its own permanent environmental news site?
Yeah, I've been talking with a number of, you know, I've only been there a couple months so far, so just going to, you know, we're building this plan to take over the world. Yeah,
don't forget the little people on your way up.
Yeah. I've done a lot of things in the past, and it's interesting. You know, just this is a great discussion because, you know, this is my third university, and I feel like I've learned a lot by the other places that I've been because every place is so different. You know, the students, the faculty, the money that you have or don't have, and what you can do, and, you know, I've done like the single, you know, single off one site or, you know, one special topic site, which is really awesome and fun. Now I'm in this system where we're like, you know, this train rolls, you know, and it's like this massive thing that I'm a part of. I have zero control over it. So that's interesting.
You can carve out your own piece of it.
Yeah, that will happen. But I feel like there, you know, there's so many different ways to do this, and there, no one of them is really wrong.
Or right.
It's kind of like, yeah, it's like, what can you do with what you have,
right.
You know, just creatively, and how can you, and, you know, I'm always thinking too, of course, I know we all are about, what are the students learning from this experience? What are they taking away from it? And to me, that's kind of a top priority. We have to think of our audience as well, but what are the students taking away from this experience that they're learning that they can apply?
You guys have sites to look at?
I do PR for basic fundamental science. Emory have a blog on emory.edu/eScienceConference.
Very good. And you? Interested observer.
Okay.
All right. Well, I promised Jay we'd be done at noon and go downstairs, and it's a sit-down lunch.